You are now tuning in to the Own the Build podcast. Join C-Link's very own Paul Hemming, where each week he interviews experts from the world of construction and asks all the important questions around intelligent construction management.
Hello and welcome to episode 142 of the Own the Build podcast with me, Paul Hemming. Today we are starting something new. We're introducing a new series called The Future of Contracting. We will be running The Future of Contracting episodes every 4 weeks. And in these episodes, we are going to be seriously taking a look at, you guessed it, the future of contracting. We'll be talking about why main contractors need a tender strategy, how to tackle the UK's quantity surveying shortage, why QSs shouldn't only have margin as their KPI, and much, much more. And for all of these episodes, I will be joined in the studio by a very close friend of mine, Christopher Barber, who is the Chief Visionary Officer at our business, C-Link and Prosper. As you know, we've created software that connects main contractors and subcontractors and saves main contractors 600 hours of quantity surveying time. We are quite sad individuals, if I'm honest with you, but both Chris and I care deeply about both main and subcontractors. I've been a subby, as you're all very much aware of, and what we want to do is grow the understanding of both sides, improve the industry, and just generally help everyone improve the future. So, Chris, I'm blabbering on here, mate. Welcome back to Own the Build.
How many episodes is this now?
Four now, mate. Too many.
Yeah. Wow, I must be doing something right.
I still must be desperate for guests, no? maybe the latter, but you're still not the number one returner. But with this series, you probably will be. So we are going to get there. So the important change, I guess, about this series, and we're going to run it every 4 weeks, like I said, is that there will be a downloadable directly linked to each show. And so if you're a main or a subcontractor and you're thinking about the future of your business, the future of the industry, go into the show notes right now and you will find an ebook titled Why Main Contractors Need a Tender Strategy. Now, when I go about writing these ebooks, I always ask you, Chris, to edit them, review them, take a look at it, to see if I'm talking nonsense, right? I come from a little town in the Midlands called Stratford-upon-Avon, and Stratford-upon-Avon is famous for William Shakespeare. The school I went to was the same school as William Shakespeare, and you knew this. And so if you read that ebook now, guys, you will see that the first sentence says something like, when Shakespeare said that Shakespeare invented the word subcontracting, right? He invented 1,700 words, apparently, that are now in our current dictionary, and one of them was subcontracting. And what he meant by that was that you would remarry. To subcontract was to remarry and to remarry and remarry. And when I read that, when I was writing this piece, I did think that is pretty hilarious in the context of the way main contractors currently manage some subcontractors, right? Because so often you remarry and you remarry and you remarry. Relationships, partnerships, they don't go on for too long. The question I have for you first and foremost, Chris, is knowing me, when you picked up that piece that was titled Why Main Contractors Need a Tender Strategy, and the first line talked about Shakespeare, what did you think?
I thought if I had a pound for every time you mentioned you went to Stratford-upon-Avon and to Shakespeare's school, I'd be a very, very rich man.
Well, I do want to be a journalist. I always wanted to be a journalist, and Shakespeare was a writer. I went to the same school, so, you know. Download the ebook, everyone, and read that. You've got to be done. All jokes aside, so we work with main contractors a lot, right? And at C-Link, we know there are high-achieving main contractors and there are main contractors who are still like on their journey to improve their tender strategy. Let's talk about what a tender strategy is, Chris. What do you think a tender strategy is, and why are you laughing so much?
What's a tender strategy?
Yeah.
I've never had one. I think you need to kind of scale it back a bit more from what is a tender strategy. I feel like that's the wrong way of looking at a project when it lands on your desk. I think it needs to go a bit more internal ops for the company and more like, what's a supply chain strategy? And I would bring it back to what is your supply chain strategy as a business before you even look at what a tender strategy is for a project, because they differ so much. And my focus would be on and we never had this. I mean, a lot of organizations don't have this. The bigger ones do, where they've got like head of supply chain or supply chain manager who is actually fostering those relationships and making them consistent through from estimating to construction and then coming back around to estimating construction again on the next set of projects. And I would look at that first before even diving into a tender strategy. What I liked was the episode with the MD of Seddon, I believe.
Peter Jackson, yeah.
Yeah, and how he's revolutionized his strategy. And it's not actually...
rocket science.
No, it's not revolutionary in the sense of just treating people like humans and just being that open and transparency and collaborative way that is probably written into all our contracts but never really adhered to.
Well, what's funny, and Peter, I imagine that you're listening because I know that you're an Own the Build listener. I loved that episode because it talked to the heart of everything that we want to change in the industry. We want main and subcontract relationship to not be remarrying, as Shakespeare would say, got it in again. But, you know, more that collaborative partnership, human relationship, and it's so simple. And we recently had a new employee join our business, and he joined in the role of product manager. And he was looking at our product, you know, he's new to the construction, main contractor, subcontractor. He was thinking about it. And he listened to that episode. And he said, it was a really interesting episode, but is that really a thing? That, you know, the main contractor and subcontractor relationship, it's such a revolutionary thing for the main contractor to invite the subcontractor into that. I think you called it a supply chain day, right? And I said, bizarrely, in some respects, it is, right? And that's true, isn't it? And it's absolutely ridiculous in some ways that that is so groundbreaking. We need to get to a point where that relationship is incredibly close. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it was amazing, really. And it takes me back. So my best friend and my partner, two different people, just to clarify that. They both work in like the retail section and they're suppliers to big retailers. And I won't mention the retailer, but they had a particularly bad reputation for letters, beginning with a certain letter called, I won't mention it, but for the purpose of this, but they had a really bad reputation. And then I think someone new came in and they were like, what are we doing to our suppliers? Why are we being so brash with them? Why are we be like giving them really tough terms to work with? We're really aggressive. And he called like a big strategy, like a big supply chain, all suppliers come in and basically said, I'm sorry, we've been dicks. Like literally, I'm so sorry. This is going to be the new way we're going to operate. We're not going to be these tough buyers that are really negotiating really, really tough with you. This is going to be our new approach to things. And then now I say, how are you getting on with so-and-so? And they say, yeah, no, it's all good now. Like it's moving in the right direction. We, you know, it's far better relationships than we had 24 or 36 months ago. And I thought of that. I thought, good, imagine if like someone in construction just did that. Yeah. And then Peter Jackson from Seddon.
Went ahead and did it, yeah. You know, on this show, in probably the last 6 months, we've had quite a lot of subbies on. We've had Mike Wharton, we've had Nicola Barden, we've had Angela Mansell. And they're prominent subcontractors. And the single biggest thing that they have said is, bring us in, talk to us. We want to speak to you. So if you're a main contractor, it's such a simple thing to do. Just open your arms and let them in. And we talked with Angela Mansell. And they are a large subcontractor. It really hit home for me because I was a large subcontractor. And the relationships we had with our supply chain, so this is subcontractor to secondary subcontractor or, you know, material suppliers, was almost, not like a family, that's cheesy, but it was super close. You could pick up the phone and it would be easy. That relationship, subcontractor to main contractor, although there will be people listening to this thinking, I know there's plenty of people I can pick up the phone to. But as a strategy, let's take it back to that word strategy, main contract, tender strategy, procurement strategy, supply chain strategy. Is your strategy to be close to your supply chain or not? All of the feedback that we've had from subcontractors since that Peter Jackson Seddon episode has been, that resonates, that's something I want to hear, that's something that I want to be a part of. So I think, in summary, the first thing is bringing that human element to it, right?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to remove it away from the commodity side of things. That's how the industries, like the subcontracting, like you were saying, remarry, you know, off-the-shelf wife, off-the-shelf subcontractor. That is like, you know, there's plenty of fish in the sea kind of mentality. It is the wrong way, and there's no... if you're going to look at any reason why the industry really struggles, it's with that very top level of not treating the supply chain right.
Shakespeare remarrying. We've got to it. So let's like contextualize this in the long term now, because if you're thinking about strategy and strategic view, it is in the long term. And so if we look at the current rate of retirement in construction is higher than the rate of employment. So as a result, an extra 225,000 construction workers are going to be needed by 2027, according to the Construction Skills Network. Build UK, their most recent people survey, revealed that 68% of companies have vacancies that they currently can't fill. The National Federation of Builders completed a survey in February 2023. 84% said that their business experienced a labour shortage, with the most frequent being carpenters, bricklayers, plasterers, dryliners. And so bad is that situation that the government added bricklayers, roofers, carpenters and joiners to the shortage occupation list to encourage migration in summer 2023. I don't want to get into Brexit, don't want to get into all of those conversations, but it is fundamental and clear that we have a skill shortage. So with that in mind, there's going to be a subcontract shortage, right? So this is something we talk about all the time at C-Link in our businesses. How do you make your business a business that subcontractors will be attracted to work with, because there's a small pool? If I was to say to you, Chris, that question, how I'm the MD of a main contractor, you're my procurement director or my commercial director, I say to you, all those stats I've just said, there's this skill shortage. Chris, how are you going to make us a business that stands out?
Well, I think you'd look at it as twofold. How my big picture thinking looks is, if you invest in your supply chain and you're giving them certainty on pipeline, right? The two things that really restrict subcontractors and the supply chain from scaling is cash flow certainty and pipeline certainty. They're the two kind of things I would say they don't have, and you can give that as an employer of those subcontractors. You can give them certainty in those areas. So by addressing that, you're allowing that subcontractor to scale, to service more of your projects and consistently service your projects.
How are you
going to
give them that certainty?
So
you haven't got the certainty yourself.
Yeah, no, I agree. But here's the big picture, right? So you're this main contractor. It doesn't happen overnight, right? Just to caveat all that. Yeah. But you're this main contractor. Your job is, you're a procurement manager or whatever, supply chain manager. You're going to come in and revolutionize it. You open up, like you have these open days like Peter did, and you really get them on board. This is what we're looking at. These are the tenders we're pricing at the moment. We think we're going to be successful in this. This is what our pipeline is looking like for the future. Mm-hmm. You get that supply chain brought into that and thinking, right, this is great. I could win. You know, you can also caveat, oh, you're not going to win everything, right? We're going to competitively tender. We need a diverse supply chain, because you might be busy, so-and-so, you might have the capabilities, et cetera. Having that transparency and that open discussion with them about, this is what's going on, we want you to be part of our journey. And then imagine what that looks like from a client perspective, looking at your profile as a business 6, 12, 18 months down the line. Mm. They might be looking at you thinking, look at how robust their supply chain is, look how much they're delivering, their capabilities are really massive. And it changes what people view your business as, because you've got this highly engaged,
you're saying both chain. Ways, right? You're saying it changes the way clients perceive you down the line, and then for the subbies up the line, they're also looking at you in a completely different way.
Yeah, because you're consistently delivering, and because you've got the supply chain bought into the whole process. So your projects are on time, on budget, that kind of to the right quality, and that's going to spread. That like quality side in the estate groups or whoever these private clients or et cetera, the word will spread, like, you should be using this contractor. They're really good. Really like dealing with them. They've got a good supply chain. They deliver X, Y, Z.
And so the challenge is, you know, we're sat here in a podcast studio talking about the best case scenario, right? And like I said to you, and you know this, so I know that you do, but main contractors are probably sitting there thinking, well, I haven't got a pipeline. I haven't got five jobs lined up. I'm saying, I'm going to divvy up X, Y, and Z. So all of these things are a challenge. But if you were a sizable main contractor, or in fact, if you were any kind of main contractor, how many, and you're going to be running two or three jobs a year, maybe more, how many subbies do you really want to have for each package, let's say dry liners, right? How many do you want to have? Because you're going to invite, Peter said this himself, he said that some of the feedback from his specialist supply chain was, why are subby X, Y, and Z here when we're here? I thought we were your dry liner, as opposed to, no, we need 3, 4, 5, I don't know. I'm interested to get your view on it to create that competitive environment. Because if you're really going to give them certainty on pipeline, how do you do that if you want that competitive process?
I think, I don't know how Peter delivered it with the people that invited to the supply chain day, but you've got to tell them, look, this is our idea. We're going to tender with X amount of subcontractors who are part of our supply chain, and they are an absolute focus for our business. You are part of that, but we're not in bed with you wholly and solely, because like that, we can't do that because of, it's risk exposure to our business. If you go under, who else do we all rely on? And there's lots of ways you could communicate it. I think just being clear from the outset on that this is what your intentions are. I'm not saying that didn't happen, but
yeah.
Absolutely clear on it. And I guess what you're saying is, how many do you rely on? Which I think is a good question, but it does depend on how big your pipeline is, right? So if you had a massive pipeline and the size of the projects you're dealing with, are they all a certain size?
Yeah.
Or have you only got a couple of big ones and then loads of smaller ones, because they might be tailored for a different type of contractor. But, you know, competitive tendering, we all know it needs to be 3 quotes back.
But is it a way, do you need to get away from that competitive tendering mindset? Because I've got 3 dry liners. I say to my dry liners at the start of the year, I'm probably going to win 3 jobs. I'm going to have 5 dry liners who I'm going to tender with, which means you've got an over 50% chance of winning one. Because I'm not going to give 2 projects to one. I'm always going to spread my risk and have 1 for each. So you're almost definitely going to win one. You've got a 60% shot. That then means to the QS or to the commercial department, project 1, great competitive tender, but 1 goes away. Project 2, great competitive tender. But then it gets to project 3, and the subbies kind of know that there's only so much that they're very likely to win that next one. Does that ruin the competitive tender process? Because do you see what I mean? Mm. It kind of makes it clear that you're not going to be competitively tendering. So is there actually, zoom out from competitive tendering, a completely different approach that needs to be taken?
I understand what you're saying. I think when we say a competitive tender, right, doesn't need to necessarily be the cheapest price. If that's kind of might be what you might be alluding to there, it could be on loads of different aspects like capabilities, current work load schedule that subcontractor's got. Performance on the last one, was it up to scratch? Could they deliver this high-end scheme, or have you got like a social housing scheme that they would be more suitable for?
Yeah.
So it is really, I just feel it's that open, full 360 loop, feedback loop that it has to go through that. And it, like I said, it won't happen overnight, but if you've got your construction and project teams actively reviewing and giving constructive feedback to that subcontractor from the estimating stage to the tendering stage to the delivery stage, all those phases, and the feedback's going in, then the person making the decision on the next project of who gets it, mm-hmm. as well as the pricing and allowances that all come in, can weigh that up against other metrics, really.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right, because we're in an environment where we're all in business to make money, right? So subcontractors understand that, main contractors understand that, and the price, the full bid has got to be right for you to win any job, right? And I think we've covered quite well here a different strategic thought to how you manage the supply chain. And we should, in the second half of the show, actually then go into the tender strategy more specifically. We've talked there about the company, how you should communicate with your subbies. Let's talk in the second half of the show about how you communicate in project. Hello, it's me again. I wanted to share a quick story with you on why I co-founded Sealink with my best mate, Chris. Chris and I, we're both QSs, and this is going to sound sad, but one night we were sat in the pub talking about subcontract tendering, and we realised the industry had a problem. Number 1, procurement was too paper-based. Number 2, it was too time-consuming, and every QS had their own unique way of doing things. And number 3, perhaps most importantly, if you want to competitively tender, you need to know hundreds of the best subcontractors. We simply didn't. That's why we created Sealink. It's software to solve subcontract tendering. We wanted to remove these challenges and help the industry get better. So if you, or someone you know, tenders with subcontractors, you've got to see our software. Head over to our link, www.get.c-link
patreon.com/podcast to find out more. I will include it in the description box. So again, there's no excuses. Now, let's get right back to the show.
So, Christopher Barber, we have talked about the strategic view of the company, right, in terms of the humanization of the relationship with the supply chain. Simple stuff, but actually requires thought process. What also requires thought process is I am on the train tracks as a QS. I understand what the company strategy is with regards to the supply chain. I know I'm going to have 5 relatively engaged, almost like partnered subcontractors who know us, know how we work, etc. The question is, and let's contextualize it, right? I'm going to be an estimator. Nightmare situation for me. I'm a QS through and through, but I'm going to be one. So I'm the estimator. We've won the job. And I'm going to come to you and I'm going to say, Chris, here's the job. Here's the tenders that I got at estimate stage. Over to you. See you later. I'm off. Talk me through like your thought process. What are your next steps to actually carve out an amazing project tender strategy?
Yeah, I mean, the most important meeting on a project is that tender handover, making sure you've got the right segments for that meeting set out in the agenda. So obviously, forget about all the client stuff. Let's talk about the tendering, right? So straight into the tendering side, for the purpose of this conversation, I would be looking at risks and opportunities. First and foremost, they're like the two key packages I'm looking at the most. So a risk perspective, I'd be looking at CDP packages. So anything that's got a design portion to it.
Piling, groundworks, M&E? Yeah,
well, piling would, not necessarily groundworks, Paul, but M&E definitely would.
You know what I mean.
Yeah. So anything that's got a lot, has got that kind of design portion, I know it's going to take more care and attention, that package. And then anything that's got long lead in items and potentially high finishes. So like a high quality finish would be like a joinery package that's also got a really long lead in time. And thinking about like the samples, mock-ups, etc., that might be required around that. So that would take a big consideration and something to really kind of delve into.
Can I ask, because I was always subby, you've done both. Lead-in times, I think that's almost a bit of a zoom out onto the company-wide, right? Mm. So how did you know what... So I'm the estimator, I'm handing it over to you. There you go, Chris. How do you know what are the average lead times per package? Is that something that you would expect the company to say, groundworks, we need X, windows, we need 12 weeks or 16 weeks? Is that something that should be a company-wide structure as expectation that the estimator should be included in the program? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, so your estimator will or should identify long lead items to you, because they've gone through, like, credit to estimators, they have to go snapshot in time. They've got a real short window to kind of price the job, allow for risks, opportunities, etc. They should identify anything that's long lead. I remember I worked on a project in the Barbican once, and there was a certain material there that was a ridiculous...
Leather wallpaper?
No, it wasn't leather, no. It was a certain type of metal profile colouring system. And it was coming from like China, and it like the timescales like almost didn't work. So we had to find an alternative in the end. But that was highlighted very early on. So estimator in short should allow for it. And it comes through experience as well, but you know, you'll see your kind of tender program that you would have agreed in the contract or outline construction program.
But should it come from experience? So I guess that's the question I'm asking. You're a pretty amazing QS, right? But should it come from experience? We're talking here about tender strategy, and we're talking about companies saying, this is our strategy with humanizing the supply chain, building those relationships, etc. Should a company say, these are our standard lead-in times across the package, and then track them and then have some kind of data feed on that? Because I don't think they do, right?
No, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, almost that standard. So we used to operate an information release schedule, the IRS schedule. That's so important. And that would be the next phase of the strategy. Mm-hmm. Because you can then, once you understand what the lead-in times and the riskier project that packages, you can then start plotting out your IRS schedule. And that's the kind of centerpiece for a QS, in my opinion, of how they manage.
You love the IRS schedule. I mean, to me, the IRS schedule was, the information release schedule, IRS, was a way for me to manage the design process, right? I would manage the design process. Now I was subby to main contractor, but it'd be almost the way that I would cultivate a claim, almost, that you would see that there has been a delay on all these things. But for you, you always talk about putting the IRS schedule at the heart of your tendering strategy. What on earth do you mean by that?
I feel like I completely agree it was the centrepiece for the delay claim. But because we had like start on dates for each package, remember, like, I was doing high-end resi, so there's a lot of intricate bits and pieces.
20, 30 different packages.
Well, even more, like, you know, I've looked back at some old schedules before in my time and thought, bloody hell, there's a lot going on in that.
Slow weekend, was it?
Yeah. There's a lot going on that kind of, on these kind of projects. They are very, very detailed. And that's, I think, that's what I mean by company to company and project to project, they all differ significantly. But for me, that would give you cold date, a drop date, when that architect or M&E engineer or structural engineer needs to give you the information by. Because if they don't, it's going to have a massive impact on your project.
Well, in some ways, then it cultivates your delay claim anyway, right?
Yeah, but it also gives me a kick up the arse to say, you can't miss this date, Chris, because if you do, you know, you're going to delay the project. So it's a bit of a management tool for internal, for the QS and project team, and
for you yourself as well.
And right? Management of information coming in, yeah.
So let's go back again. I'm estimator, hand it over to you. We talk about lead times. I say, have a look at that one on the windows, or have a look at that on audio visual. There's going to be a long lead time on that. Yeah. Your process then is to build your own IRS schedule, and that IRS schedule, you're then going to use as your own measuring, like for your tender program, to keep yourself on track. But also you're going to pass it to the client and to the consultant team. Is that right to say, this is my expectation if you want me to deliver on the program?
Yeah, and there is, I think in the JCT, either the architect does the IRS, but they normally scribble that out, and it's down to the contractor. So we used to do it on pretty much every job. And it was actually a good process for us to do anyway. It was like, literally, project starts, start your IRS schedule, like just get it.
So how would that look? Because to me, I'm instantly thinking that that is only a good thing to do that, actually. Not only is it a way to manage yourself and to manage your team internally, but if you say to the client, windows are meant to be on site on the 20th of April, therefore I need a decision on 1st of January or whatever it would be, as per the IRS, and then they come back on the 1st of Feb, that's actually a great thing client-wise, right, to go back to them and say, you were late.
Yeah, I mean, you take your construction program, you take your packages of works that, you know, using either the bill of quantities or there's various ways, and just making sure that's all fleshed out. I do a big element of that, like either listing out the packages and then the start dates. And then it would be a collaboration with the site manager and project manager to kind of fill in those durations. And then we'd even know, like we'd do a deep dive into the spec. That's what I mean by going into these high risk items and say, you know, there's a mock-up required for that. So we've got to account for that within that, in these durations. And, oh, there's a sample. We need to allow for a sample approval period. Oh, there's drawings required on this. We need a drawing approval period. And these extra steps that you then you build that out, and then you know when you're going to be comfortable to place that order. And that is such a great process. And that is why I talk. If you had a pound for every time I said it,
yeah, you do say it a lot. But I think you actually touched on a really good point, because I honestly believe there is a lot of construction contracts which people enter into before and they sign it, and they're signing a death wish. And I think you've kind of just exemplified a pretty good example, because, you know, so often you're signing a contract, you sign that contract and you've already started on site, and there will be a CDP item. Now, if there's a CDP item, what does that mean? That means there's probably a mock-up, there's probably a sample, there's definitely technical drawings, there's definitely an approval process. And just what I've said there, I've probably plotted out at least 10 weeks, right? At the very, very best. So what you're actually saying, and now it's starting to make sense with the pennies after all of these times, Chris, and it's starting to drop, that you're actually saying, I've been handed the job by the estimator, I'm picking it up, and I'm saying from day dot, the piling, the M&E, whatever it is, my task starts minus 10 weeks or minus 20 weeks, whatever it is, and you're instantly putting that back to the client and saying, by the way, you gave me the contract late. I need this now. Otherwise, we're in delay. Because so often, the boot feels like it's on the other foot, doesn't it? When you're the main contractor, you start and you've got a gun pointing to your head. By doing that IRS process, you're actually pushing it immediately back. So I completely understand.
Yeah. And we used to obviously report on the IRS in every meeting as well, progress meeting with the client. So it's real, like, open, transparent. And you could have these, what's coming up? What packages are we coming up? Have we got the design information in place? But also, like, we're talking about a lot around risks, and like that's obviously a big important part. But what we do through that process as well, I would look at opportunities. So provisional sums, I shouldn't maybe look at it as an opportunity, but you know, as a
why would you look at it as an opportunity?
I think there's always that provisional sums are an area for you to maximize your, if you consider a tender, right? When you're tendering, you're going to go in super competitive, maybe a low margin because you want to win that project. Mm. You got a provisional sum. Now it's, you can almost look at it, it's like a variation kind of style. It's, I need to maximize the profitability for this item. And that's like how it should be looked at, really, yeah. In my opinion, because at tender stage, you've gone in competitive to win it and you want to show the client how good you are. But now it's provisional sum. This is just my view, obviously.
Yeah.
I want to maximize that. And then I'd also look at equal approved as well as an item for exploration and of opportunity. So I'd look at those kind of areas for opportunity. And what I would do then is then that helps me understand how I'm going to tender each package. So if it's a provisional sum, I'd be looking at making sure I've allowed for absolutely every nut and bolt on that certain element. Mm-hmm. So I'd be really collaborating with the subcontractor, saying like, what attendances do you need? Is there anything else that we need to provide? Is there another consideration, etc.? Making sure that is robust. I'm not leaving a penny on the table for that item. And then equal approved, I'd be looking at that in depth and going, right, they've specified this system. It's equal approved. When I send my tender out, I'm going to say, give me option one as per spec and give me an option two, your preferred equal approved option.
So you've hit on a really, really interesting point. Tender strategy. What is the psyche of your commercial team once you've given up? You're on the train tracks, taking it back to that example. What is the psyche? And what you're saying is your psyche was whenever there is a equal approved or provisional sum, your process is, as I understand it, I'm going to go to my 5 trusted subcontractors. I'm going to speak to them and I'm going to say, option one is price what they've asked for. Option two is price something that is loads better for both you and us, and we'll share it or we'll make it work much better to us. And that, you know, this all ties in. I'm going to pull it all the way back now to those conversations, those pre-tender meetings, those supply chain event days where you're setting the tone, right? Where you say, you know, that equal approved or it's got to be spec'd as per X. Whenever that happens, if we work together, we'll go 50-50 on it, but this will be our approach. Option one and option two. If we go hard at it, we'll make more money. It'll be better for both of us. And that sets the standard. If I was a subby hearing that from a main contractor, and I was, I'd love that, right? Do you see, it all filters back to that. What are your themes? And also, you know, going back to the lead-in times, I was saying to you there, should a main contractor have standard lead-in times for Schüco, Reynolds, all these different types of windows, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to talk about windows, you know, that's all I've got. But you see, if you said to your dry liners or to whoever, every 3 months, we're going to have this meeting, we're going to have this conversation together, and you're going to tell me all about your specialism, you're going to tell me all about the changes in pricing, all about the changes in lead times, and we're going to have that for our estimators. So they're going to include it at all different levels, then seeps down to the QSs, and then seeps down into how the QS runs the job in exactly the way you're describing. How much better would that be?
That would be far better landscape for everyone, wouldn't it? And it's a difficult one because I was doing that without...
You were doing it just because you were good QS.
Yeah, but I was doing that without the top level supply chain strategy.
Yeah.
And that was the bit, that was one of the big issues. I just didn't have that pool of...
Why was it an issue then? Because if you're managing the job intelligently and well as a QS, what was holding you back by not having that big strategy?
Lack of supply chain, really, to kind of do that collaboration with who pre-existing relationships that you could lean on and go into. You know, having to foster new relationships is a difficult process, and it's time consuming when you look at the volume of packages that we used to deliver and the kind of diversity of them and the nature.
How many would you have, right? So you as a, again, you'd have been working on, not you personally, but that company would have been working on 3, 4, 5 different jobs per year or at a time. How many subbies would you have per package roughly at that company? And why did it feel like that wasn't enough?
Basically one per package. Like literally it was kind of around that. And it was almost as good as your last job kind of thing. No real detailed kind of feedback loop. What happened, you know, real analysis. Whose fault was it? Was it just finger pointing, etc.? The common things that happen. rather than it being a constructive approach. To say.
Strategic.
Yeah, constructive and strategic. So if they didn't perform, why didn't they? Let's understand that. It's not pointing fingers at anyone. Was it the wrong type of project for them? Was that the issue? Right. And
yeah, did we have the wrong lead times? Was the scope wrong?
Yeah.
Did we run the IRS? Did we speak to them beforehand about how we wanted to manage the job? Did we bring them in? Did they trust us? Blah, 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 blah. It's all the same thing, isn't it? Yeah.
And my firm believing is you can't deliver what that tender strategy that I just talked about there, you can't deliver that without the supply chain strategy.
So in short, no matter how good your QS team and your commercial department is, if you don't have the supply chain and the relationship with that supply chain, you're going to struggle. Okay, I mean, I think, you know, for the first Future of Contracting episode, we've covered quite a lot there. And my takeaways are, obviously, first and foremost, that humanizing that subcontract supply chain relationship, bringing them in, holding those events in the way that Seddon are doing. I think it's a really, really great way to work. Humanizing those relationships. IRS, you're going to love that I said that, but I'm on board with you now. We're going to go with the IRS. And then, you know, lead times, data. Who's holding that data in the main contract department, and how is that helping the estimator? How is it helping the QS, et cetera, et cetera? I think we've covered quite a lot there, Chris. What do you think?
Yeah, I think we solved it, haven't we?
I wouldn't say we've solved it, but we're going to have many, many more of these Future of Contracting episodes to come back to. And guys, don't forget, because if you go to the show notes right now, you can leave us a nice review and rating, which you've probably already done, but click on the link. You'll be able to download the ebook, see what we've written about on this topic. In a similar vein to how we've talked about it now, you also get a little bit of Shakespearean flair in there from me. I will be back next week. Chris and I will be back in 4 weeks talking about another topic. Chris, thanks for coming on the show, mate. That was great.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Catch you later.
Cheers.